You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
AJ, when is this coming out?
April 26th.
I really enjoyed reading it. It's like my favorite topic in the world, and you wrote about it. So two of my favorite things, AJ Jacobs writing and a book about puzzles that even mentioned as a whole chapter on chess.
That you were helpful with. You were my consultant, if I recall.
No, Cyrus Lakdawala was.
I know, but you were the behind-the-scenes consultant.
Okay, I'll go along with that.
thank you. First of all, I'm enjoying the list feature that you were doing.
Oh,
I
good.
I think that's great.
Yeah.
Listen, if you ever need me to be a guest on that, I'm happy to anytime.
Yeah, you know what you do? Make a list on notepad.com. Maybe we can make a list about the puzzler. Notepad.com, N-O-T-E-P-D.com. And it's like Twitter combined with the ability to make idea lists and search other people's idea lists, making lists every day.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to join. I am going to join. That'll be great. And also, I miss good or bad. So I'm ready to, I don't know how your schedule is, but after the 26th, like give me a week after the 26th or so, but maybe we could do another one.
Yeah. I mean, the first topic could be puzzles, good or bad, because
great idea.
As you probably encountered in your so the first thing people should know about you is that when you pick a topic to write about, you don't just write like this boring thing like, oh, here's the history of this topic, here's some interesting things, here's some interviews I did. You immerse yourself in the topic. Like when you wrote about genealogy, you broke the record for the world's largest family reunion. When you were there as a speaker. I was just talking about this with people the other day, because I remember I checked in with my cousin Dr. Oz, and George Church was speaking right before me, and he's like the premier scientist in genomics, and then you had the band We Are Family singing on the stage. So
I tried to throw a good party for all of my cousins. Yeah, the point of that book was that we're all cousins, all 7 billion of us. So I tried to throw the biggest party for all my cousins. We didn't get 100% of the 7 billion, but we got a few thousand, including James. But yes, you're right. That is sort of the way I like to write, by becoming a human guinea pig and going all in. So whether it's following all the rules of the Bible as literally as possible, from the Ten Commandments to stoning adulterers.
And the year of living biblically, where you actually did stone an adulterer in Central Park.
Right. Very small, like pebbles. I don't want to give
but,
the right
But an
impression.
Act of violence nonetheless.
It is probably technically illegal. Well, he threw them at me first, if you recall. He was very angry that I was going to stone adulterers. Anyway, that is what I like to do. And
it's very
unique.
It makes it so entertaining, like, that you're doing it. So it's not like it gives you a different perspective than someone who's just writing like a regular nonfiction book.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I like to take the reader along on this adventure and this journey, and then also have takeaways, because I know from my friend James Altucher, you want takeaways in the book. You want to give the reader something that changes their life for the better. So I try to combine that with the James Altucher advice.
All about, again, one of my favorite topics, puzzles of all sorts. You have chapters on everything from anagrams, which are, you know, words that are, the letters are out of order and you have to figure out what the word is, to math puzzles, to crossword puzzles, to mazes, riddles, chess puzzles, Sudoku and Ken and Rubik's Cube and so on. And
that's an impressive, you've remembered all those. Yeah.
Oh, by the way, I've been taking memory lessons. So,
they're working. Tell your teacher.
And you immerse yourself in it. Like, tell me some of the things you did, because I was jealous of every single thing you were doing. Like, I can't believe how jealous I was.
Right. Well, the book is a combination of sort of a history, my memoir of my lifelong love of puzzles, these lessons you can learn of how to be a better thinker in real life, the secrets by using the secrets of puzzles. But for me, my favorite part is going on these crazy adventures to meet these wild subcultures. So I did everything from I went to Spain and represented the United States in the World Jigsaw Puzzle Championship. I went to the headquarters of the CIA and looked at one of the most famous unsolved puzzles in the world. I played Garry Kasparov in chess to learn about chess puzzle.
What, he played you a game?
Well, I shouldn't say that. We played puzzles together.
Okay.
So we collaborated. And I went to the hardest corn maze and got hopelessly lost and frustrated. So it was all of these wild... Oh, and the MIT Mystery Hunt, which is like the hardest scavenger hunt in the history of humanity. Just crazy.
When you described one of the puzzles, which you had the final... answer for. So there's 150 puzzles that you have to solve in the scavenger hunt, and you solved or helped solve one of them. But the steps it took for them, your teammates, to come up with that were so ludicrous. I can't even imagine. Like, I always think I'm good at puzzle type thinking, but I can't even imagine thinking that way.
No, it was hilarious. The MIT Mystery Hunt is the Ironman Triathlon for nerds. So what happens is every January, 2,000 of the smartest people in the world gather in Boston at MIT, and they're not kids. They're like, you know, real rocket scientists and doc, and they compete for 72 straight hours, sometimes not sleeping, to solve 150 of these insane puzzles that don't have directions. They make no sense. There'll be like one will be a fortune cookie and inside is a fortune with just random symbols. And that's the puzzle. And so I joined one of the champion teams, which by the way is 50 people, because you need that. These puzzles are so hard that one person can't solve them. You need someone who's like a surgeon, a brain surgeon who knows about that.
You literally need a surgeon on your team.
We needed, because the puzzle that I worked on was based on the game Operation, and it involved it was the grossest game puzzle I've ever done. You had to look at video footage of surgery, try to figure out what the surgery was. Oh, that's a gallbladder operation. Figure out the insurance, a number for that, and then do like eight other...
Okay, but that was the leap. That was incredible to me. Like, so you have a pic, correct me if I'm wrong, it started with a picture of a body. Like, mm-hmm. How did it start? So that particular one of the 150 puzzles, how did that start?
Yeah, this one was called Operation, and it was sort of a riff on the old game Operation. But instead of when you pressed on the body part, a footage of actual surgery would come up. And you had to know exactly what kind. So not just that it's nose surgery. You had to know that it's, you know, surgery to get the polyp out.
And so then only a general surgeon. Like, oh, you can't even be just a surgeon. You have to be like just recently graduated from medical school to know all those different types of surgeries all over the body.
I think we had several surgeons on the team, so that might have helped. And then you had to make this conceptual leap to figuring out that you had to use the insurance number. Now, there was some sort of vague hint. I can't remember exactly in the instructions where it gave some sort of hint, but I would never have made that leap. And that's what I love, the mental leaps. I think that's, and that's what you're good at. You talk about idea sex, where you take two different things, like, you know, toasters and space travel, and then you mate them, and it's a toaster in space.
That's interesting because a lot of these, and I want to get back to this one riddle, like, because it was amazing, but I mean, the one puzzle you solved, but a lot of the puzzles, if you think about it, are examples of idea sex, like two different, completely disparate notions or ideas or concepts that are combined together. Like that happens in crossword puzzles or these cryptics that you described. But okay, finish the So they basically take every operation. For some reason, they find the insurance code
they need to find the insurance code for what that operation is. And then what do they do with the insurance codes?
You know what? I cannot even remember. There are like 14 different steps that you had to do. I don't know, some sort of quadratic equation with the insurance codes. And eventually, every puzzle eventually solves to one word. And you have to send that word in to the evil geniuses who are running the hunt and say, and in this case, it was tracheostomy. It wasn't even tracheotomy. It was tracheostomy, which is another way to spell it. And that turned out to be right. And I actually did help a tiny bit, but in the easiest way, I used the Wheel of Fortune strategy. So there were all these letters that were there and some that were missing. And I was able to say, hey, I think that this is tracheotomy.
But it was like, it was B underscore, 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 K underscore, GE. And you said blockage.
Oh, right, block, because it wasn't even the final answer. It was like step 3 out of 14. But I felt I contributed.
That's a contribution.
Like 0.1%.
Your years of watching Wheel of Fortune paid off.
That's it. And I love this event because one of the contestants said, his wife is saying, tells him, these are some of the smartest people in the world, and they spend 3 days on these ridiculous puzzles. Why aren't they curing cancer? And he said, well, these are the people who are curing cancer the other 360 days of 2 days of the year. These are their 3 days to get together and I think practice their skills and become even better and more creative thinkers. That's one of the points of the book, is that puzzles are great practice. They're not a waste of time.
I want to talk about that because you can make many arguments about that. I mean, there's something primal about puzzles. People have been doing puzzles and riddles since the birth of our species.
Before that,
I'm sure. And you even refer to there's some kind of like religious element. Like for instance, they're even like one of the earliest Sudoku-like puzzles are these magic squares where no matter, it's a square, like let's say 10 by 10 or 5 by 5. And no matter which way you add up rows or columns, they all add up to the same number. By the way, diagonals as well. I just wanted to mention that because in the book, I'm not sure you mentioned diagonals.
Oh, really? But, I meant to.
But and then Benjamin, you show an example from Benjamin Franklin. He made this enormous magic square. I don't even know how he
did
it. And because he loved puzzles. But you mentioned how like even in ancient Egypt, people would like wear these magic squares. Like there was almost like this religious element because a solved puzzle is almost like a form of enlightenment or nirvana, like a mini enlightenment.
Oh, I love that. I guess I touched on that, but I loved your point that it informs religion. It's in every part of human life. That's what I learned. So religion, certainly war. There's tons of puzzles in war, secret codes and
cipher
and romance. I loved there were these stories of in the 1800s, the people would, their version of sexting was to send secret coded messages in the newspaper classified. So that was the way they communicated.
Oh, yeah.
So they would say like, one was, I have the most beautiful horse in the land, but not the most beautiful lady. And it's killing me, signed GK. But it was coded in this, and you had to decipher it. And who knows whether he eventually hooked up, whether it was a successful pickup line. But I love that it's woven into every part of our lives. And I think what you said is the reason is because we're wired for it from the dawn of history, before history. Monkeys using a stick to get out termites, that's solving a puzzle. To me, puzzle is anything where you use creative thinking to achieve a goal. So I define it very broadly. And this one I just learned after the book came out. After I finished writing the book, that slime molds solve puzzles. They don't have a brain, but they solve puzzles. So they are good at mazes. You put food at the end, other side of a maze, and a slime mold will solve the maze to get to it.
Now, will it solve it perfectly, or will it make mistakes along the way and then back up and try other paths?
I'm guessing it's more of a trial and error type thing.
That would be amazing if they have like some
Right. That would be good.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, there's so many different directions to go, but, you know, puzzles are almost like a safe way to practice these real world difficulties. Like, let's say, you know, 40,000 years ago, you're living in the jungle. You don't know, you know, which direction is the evil tribes that will kill you, which direction are the animals that will kill you, which plants and trees have poisonous fruit as opposed to food that's safe to eat. So these are all puzzles that you have to figure out. Like, if there's a rustling in the wind, what does it mean? Is it wind or is it the tribe coming to attack you? And it seems like developing puzzle thinking by solving actual puzzles is like practice for the real world. And so maybe that's why we get these, like, our brain cells, our dopamine rewards us for solving puzzles, because it's going to help our survival. Like, the better puzzle solver will, you know, his descendants or her descendants will live, while the not so good puzzle solver, their descendants won't live.
Exactly. If you want to survive, if you want to, right, puzzles will save your life. But I totally agree. And actually, Paul Bloom, who you probably had on the show, he's a great psychologist. He was at Yale. Now he's at Toronto. But he's one of the ones I interviewed. Why do we love puzzles so much? And it's exactly what you say. Puzzles are like play for solving big life problems. And he says play is so important. You know, that's why young dogs wrestle with each other, because they're honing their skills. So when they get in an actual fight, they'll be good. So, and it's like what you say, you know, your vision informed a lot of this book, because I love, you always say that you spend 15 minutes every day, whatever it is, brainstorming new ideas. And you said, it doesn't matter if they're good. It's that you are using the brain as a muscle, so that when you do confront a problem, and I think the one you used as an example was, you know, you have a flat tire and you don't have a jack, what do? And that will help you stay creative. And same with puzzles. That's what puzzles are.
It's real true, because you could read about, like, let's say you read an inspirational biography of somebody who inspires you and you see how they solve things. That's great, but it won't improve your ability to solve things. I realize that you have to actually do the thing that you're practicing to be better at. You can't just, like, reading how to be better at something will only get you like 1% of the way there or 2% of the way there. It's good clues, but it's not going to get you there. Like, if I read about how to play better tennis, okay, maybe that'll give me some ideas when I play, but you have to actually play to get better. And usually you have to play with a coach. Like, when you do these, like the MIT puzzle, you're not playing with a coach, but you're playing with 50 people on your team who you're learning from. So that helps as well.
And they are very aware. They have meta strategies that they think about, like, here's how we're going to attack this problem. We're going to break it into these chunks, or we're going to do it reverse engineer it. We're going to, turn it upside down. And that was one of the great lessons of this adventure, is I could use, like, this one was in the book, so you might remember it, but there's a guy in a cell, 10 by 10 by 10, and the floor is dirt. There's no way out, no doors, except there is a skylight. So he starts digging, and he's digging and digging and digging. And what is he doing? Why? He knows he can't get out through the floor. It just keeps going down. So why is he digging? And if you remember, the answer is he is building a hill, because he's not just digging. He's doing the opposite. He's building a mountain. So you got to look at this problem from the opposite. He's going to build a little hill and climb out through the skylight. And I use that type of thinking all the time, just reversing my thinking. I think it's how Henry Ford came up with the assembly line. You know, everything, people stay in their place and the car moves instead of the opposite. It's how I use it even when I'm doing laundry. The other day I was picking up, instead of bringing the laundry to the hamper, I realized I have laundry strewn all over my apartment because I have three young boys. I'm going to bring the hamper to the laundry, and it will save me several trips. So That's just one example of creative thinking that puzzles have helped me.
See, and this kind of challenges your definition of a puzzle, because yes, creative thinking is required, but, and I'm talking about human-made puzzles right now. We'll get to other computer-made puzzles in a sec, and maybe we won't get to it. We'll see. But there's something very specific about puzzles, is that there's an artistry to them where just going through the steps to solve something won't solve a good puzzle. So like if I have a math problem, you could say every math problem is a puzzle. Like if I have to do 685 times 572, you could argue, okay, I've got to think creatively to solve this problem. But that would be wrong. Like puzzles aren't like that. Puzzles require some extra twist that does give you that enlightenment. Like you mentioned, and I'm not going to focus on chess puzzles, I promise, but you mentioned in that chapter, there was a type of puzzle called a grotesque, and you were given the puzzle and you intuitively knew that, oh, there seemed to be like an obvious answer, but the obvious answer can't possibly be the solution because this is a puzzle, not just what's the best move here. So you had to find some quirky way to solve it. And if people want to solve it in your book, I won't say how you solved it, but you know, there's kind of like a clever twist in a puzzle. Like with the guy digging, it's not just that he's digging. You also have to think, what's he doing with this dirt? Because it's enclosed, he has to be building a hill. Or there was many examples of this throughout the book. And now I'm going to forget some of them. But there were many examples where, like particularly in the cryptics, you know, where you're trying to find a word. And part of the sentence is sort of a weird clue for the word. And part of the sentence is the definition of the word.
Right. These are cryptics are like crosswords, but 18,000 times more sadistic. And they are all, but yes, I love that. And I totally agree. Puzzles require some level of ingenuity, a twist. That's at the heart of a great puzzle. And I think that that's at the heart of great ideas, though. You know, that yes. is when you make a great leap. So, like the mRNA vaccine, that was. Instead of, you know, that was like, instead of trying to recreate the entire protein, the entire virus, then let's just create a little part. And we know that that won't actually hurt us, but it'll still stimulate the immune system. So that's like totally a novel, twisty idea. And that's what I love. But yeah, I am glad that you liked the grotesque. Had you ever heard that phrase, grotesque?
No, I had never heard that phrase, you know, and I've been solving chess puzzles since I was a little kid, actually. But I agree with Garry Kasparov, who you mentioned in the book. He doesn't like the grotesques because they're not going to appear in real games. And I sort of agree with him, but they're still fun to solve, you know.
Yeah, well, they just make me laugh. I never thought I would laugh at an arrangement of chess pieces on a board. But a grotesque is all 16 black pieces arranged in crazy, like in a corner, and then two white pieces. And you have to do it so that that white wins. But Garry was great. First of all, he insulted me. That's how he started.
He means well.
Well, he came over to my apartment and I had spent all day setting up and I had the chessboard all ready in an arrangement. And he got there and he said, "This is a very cheap chessboard." And I was like, "Oh," he's like, "Oh, so cheap plastic." And I was like, "I'm sorry, should I get another one?" And he's like, "No, I'm from the Soviet Union. I'm used to cheap chessboards." So I guess I dodged a bullet. But he talks a lot. I like when he talks about the long game and sometimes you have to do surprising things like sacrifice a queen. That is short-term crazy, like the dumbest thing you can do. But long-term, sometimes it pays off.
Yeah, I mean, like, you could think about every game is a series of puzzles. Like, you're in a move in a game, and the puzzle is, what is the best move I should take? And I'm not just talking about chess. I'm talking about checkers. I'm talking about Risk. I'm talking about Monopoly. Like, given a set of choices, it's a puzzle. What choice should I make? And it's hard. Like every chess position is a puzzle of sorts. But there's a whole, like, people don't realize, like, people like Vladimir Nabokov, the famous writer of Lolita and other books, he was there was a title for it. He was a master of chess composition. He composed puzzles and achieved like a master ranking at it. And it's an art form.
And that's what he said. He says it's got all the elements of great art form. It's got surprise and deceit and form and I can't symmetry. Who knows? Whatever he said.
And to win a game, like any game of any kind, you have to do something unexpected. Like play tennis, to win a game of tennis, you have to hit the ball on the other side of the court that your opponent was expecting. So, you know, that's a common way to win. And it's difficult to do because as you get better and better, people expect, you know, there's a wider range of things they expect you to do.
Right. And I think that is one definition of games is that it's two people playing puzzles at the same time. You know, they each have their own puzzle and the opponent is part of the puzzle.
You can even say, I wonder if you can even sort of define the quality of a game. Like, is this a good game or a bad game based on how many puzzles there are in the game? In other words, like take Monopoly. Monopoly is a pretty good game, but sometimes, you know, you roll the dice. So that's an element of chance. And you land on a square and you have to do what the square tells you to do. So it's not like you have a puzzle every move. You only have a puzzle maybe on half the moves. But those puzzles though will be instrumental in like, you know, having a strategy for solving puzzles in Monopoly is how you beat your opponents.
Right. I guess, most games have an element of luck and an element of skill. And the skill part is where the puzzles come in. So if you've got chutes and ladders, that has practically no puzzle except for, like, how do I spin the little spinner thing. So, but good games are all about puzzles. And that's kind of, I took it even further, though, because I started to see everything in life as a puzzle. You know, my marriage is a puzzle. This book is a puzzle. How do I put it together? Your producer Jay was saying that me assembling this mic was a puzzle because I was having trouble with that. And I love that. I love the idea of seeing everything as a puzzle because you know why? It makes conversations. If you see a conversation as a puzzle instead of an argument, I find that not just more pleasant, but more productive. So if I'm talking to someone from the other side of the political spectrum, instead of trying to berate them and tell them they're dumb and tell them, you know, look at these facts, I treat it as a puzzle. Why do we disagree? What do we really disagree about? What evidence is there that we could change? What evidence could change my mind? So that, to me, is one of the only ways out of this nightmare, this culture war, is to treat the other people, treat the issues like a puzzle that you're solving together, that you are not trying to beat the other person down.
Yeah, like, you know, if you think about it, let's say you're arguing with someone in some debate. Again, you both could take logical approaches. You both have your reasoning. Some of it, you know, if you're on the other side of someone else, you think some of their reasoning is ridiculous, but they don't. And how do you push forward? And you could use puzzle-like thinking. A, what's something unexpected that the other side did not think of, for instance? B, what's my end goal here? Is my end goal to defeat this person so he changes his behavior or she? Or is my end goal to be friends with this person, in which case I might not fight as strongly? Or is my end goal to learn something or maybe just, you know, so in a puzzle, you often think of, like a jigsaw puzzle, you think of what the final picture looks like, and then you put the pieces together accordingly. If you didn't have the final picture, it would be much more difficult. You know, in chess, you think of what does the final checkmate look like and how could it occur, and you work backwards from that, and so on. So, yeah, puzzle-like thinking could make you a more interesting conversationalist because you have to think of something different to bring up.
Yeah, I love that.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, I, of course, the first thing I thought was I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours. And they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
By the way, I love that idea of what is the goal and working backwards. That I used in tons of puzzles. And that is one of the big... Here, let me give you one. You might know this one.
So, probably not. Go for it.
Pretend you don't. Pretend you don't. Well, you don't have to pretend. But it's a famous story of the mathematician Gauss, who was, I think, in the 1600s, maybe 1700s. And he, his teacher, he was at school, and his teacher said, All right, everyone. The assignment is to add up all the numbers from 1 to 100. And he paused for maybe 10 seconds, and then he raised his hand and he says, "I got it." And the teacher's like, "What? That's impossible. You're a liar." And he says, "No, I got it." And what he did was he did a strategy that was unexpected, but much more efficient and clean. So do you know what strategy he used?
Yeah. Because, okay, I know the thinking process. So like, let's say you're adding up the numbers from 1 to 100. It's going to be 99 plus 1.
Exactly.
Plus 98 plus 2. So it's 100 times...
101, because you do 1 right. and 100. So it's 101, 99 plus 2. So
right,
you're
so it's n times n plus 1 divided by 2, something like that.
Exactly. So it's 50 couplets, each adding up to 101, which is 5,050, which is not that hard. And so what he did is, instead of doing the expected, like 1 plus 2 is 3, plus 3 is 6, he stepped back and said, is there a better, he said, what is my end goal? My end goal is to add up all of these numbers. Is there a better way to do it? Is there a shortcut? And he realized, yes, there is. So I love that. Don't just, when you see a puzzle or see a problem, don't just dive in and start grinding away. Like, pause, step back and say, is there a faster way to do it, a better way to do this?
Yeah, it's fascinating because, like, if you think about it, the teacher told him, add up all the numbers, you know, from 1 to 100, say. And if you follow that literally, you do think, oh, of course, 1 plus 2 plus 3, and you kind of go in order. But he had the insight or the kind of the practice to not always go in order or not take too literally what people are saying. And you have to
right.
you have to not take too literally things in order to solve puzzles. If you literally take the clues for a crossword puzzle, you would never solve a crossword puzzle.
Yeah, a good crossword puzzle is a good crossword puzzle, and this is a big debate in the crossword community, but a good one is, to me, is not like, what's this river in the Czech Republic, and someone is leaning on their horn. That is not a good solution to a problem, I don't think. But they, to me, a good crossword clue is all about wordplay. And that's actually Will Shortz, the New yeah. York Times editor. If you ask him what is his favorite clue, it is a wordplay one. It is something like, this turns into a different story. This turns into a different story.
This turns
and the
into,
answer
that's
is...
the clue. Hold on. This turns into a different story. But see, these are really hard. Like, I always have trouble with these
well,
types
you
of...
know, this is a lot... I mean, it helps if I give you... It's two words... They both start with S, and they're kind of longish words. So think of another, what's another meaning of story? That's what you immediately...
I was going to say like a skyscraper or
yes,
something.
Yes, exactly.
That's
so
the answer?
What,
oh, no, no.
Okay. No, but that is the right meaning of the word story. So if something turns and you step into a new story on something that turns...
Yeah, like a staircase or something.
Yes, that's it.
Oh, okay.
But what kind of staircase? One that
spiral
goes,
staircase.
Spiral staircase. You got it with no help at all.
Well,
no
I did help get help. I did get help. You were egging
help.
Me on. You were giving me clues. Yeah, no, I think with Will Shortz, since he became the editor of the New York Times crossword puzzle, it's been a lot less about trivia and how much you know about celebrities and literature and more about wordplay.
Right.
Which I really don't like. I really don't like crossword puzzles because I don't want to know about all these cultural artifacts that, you know, the crossword puzzle creator makes. And some people love it. I just don't.
Wait, so you don't like the wordplay or you don't like the trivia?
I don't like the trivia.
Oh, yeah.
And
no,
even a lot
I
of the
agree.
Wordplay involves knowing things about the world. So I like right. puzzles that are self-contained. So,
got it.
Like, I don't have to know anything about the world to play a Sudoku puzzle, for instance.
Right, right.
Or to solve a maze or to solve a jigsaw puzzle. So, whereas wordplay, even with simple wordplay, you kind of have to know other things.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And I will say, I have not been a fan of puns for most of my life. Mm-hmm. But this year, I mean, puzzle people are so obsessed with puns. In fact, I went to a puzzle-themed wedding where they at traded vows, like, I can promise you that you will always amaze me. And it was like, oh. So it was a mixture of groan and like, aw. But here's why I gained a little respect for puns, is because they remind us that the root of puns is that one word has multiple meanings. And to be aware of that when you're just reading the news is so important, because otherwise you can be tricked into, so if someone is talking about freedom, you know, freedom means 100 different things. So freedom could mean the free market, but freedom could also mean freedom from monopoly. And, you know, if you have a total free market, it might end up in a monopoly. So you've got to be very careful. And that's what puns help me, just be wary of the English language.
It's so interesting because, like, taking something serious again, and again, this idea that getting good at puzzles is practice for real world things. Take the U.S. Constitution. It's one gigantic puzzle. Otherwise, we wouldn't have all this entire, we wouldn't have a Supreme Court that is constantly needed to correctly or incorrectly interpret the Constitution. Like, that's their job, is to basically take this wordplay that we call the Constitution and interpret it for modern times in a,
right.
Constantly. That's what they do all day, every day.
That's a great one, yeah. And what can I give you some of the more painful wordplay that I came across? Well, this is, the British crosswords are especially known for their painful wordplay. So, for instance, a clue might be just these letters, G-E-G-S, gegs, G-E-G-S. And I don't know if you remember that from the book. I think I mentioned it in the book.
I don't remember that one.
Well, that's good, because then you'll have, I mean, for me, I spent, again, it's all about changing perspective. So I spent all of my time like, what the hell is a geg? And I even Googled it. A geg is...
Is that the only clue? G-E-G-S?
That's it. And the answer is two words.
Wait, what's the premise of the puzzle? Like, what are you supposed to figure out?
Well, it's just a crossword. It's filling in spaces. So G-E-G-S is a clue for... The answer is two words. The first word is, I think, 9 letters, and the second word is 4 letters.
And that's all you know.
That's all you got.
G-E-G-S is a clue, is the only clue for two words. One is 9 letters, one has 4 letters.
Right. So, I think it's 9. Someone else can yell at me if I got it wrong. But
and it's a wordplay thing. I don't have to know like some British historical fact.
No. This one is wordplay that you would know. A 4-year-old kid would know it. It is, I won't tell you the answer, but the key is you got to get out of this gegs. You know, geg was, I looked it up, it's the airport code for Portland. I was like, what the hell does that have to do with anything? But you have to totally abandon that way of thinking and just look at it from a whole new angle. And you realize, well, let's look at the gegs. Like,
okay, let me ask you a question. Were the gegs capitalized or not capitalized?
It doesn't matter. In this case, it was, all 4 letters were capitalized. But it could be either way. And think about the letters. What if you rearranged the letters? What would happen?
Well, you have eggs.
Yeah.
So, and then scrambled eggs.
Scrambled eggs.
So
there it is.
That's interesting. So it's an anagram that leads to scrambled eggs.
Right.
I like practicing anagrams because I used to play a lot of Scrabble. So that's all about solving anagrams.
Right. Yeah, that is I am a fan too. I didn't realize anagrams had this long, crazy history. So there were like Alexander the Great had a dream, and he had a word in his dream and he didn't know what it meant. And he asked the soothsayers and they said, oh, well, if you rearrange the letters in the word, it means that you should attack this city. So anagrams have caused wars.
Wow.
And all sorts of other crazy things in history.
So let me ask you a couple questions. Like, first off, you were in this world jigsaw puzzle competition, and you described how the Russian team like destroyed everybody, and you guys finished one puzzle though. I mean, you had like, I think it was 4 jigsaw puzzles you had to do by the end of the day, or?
Right. It was, you had 8 hours to solve 4 big jigsaw puzzles, and we got in there on a fluke because no one else from the U.S. had applied, but there were 40 other countries, and all of the other people would you know, spend hours a day practicing, and they were remarkable. They were like the LeBron James of, and their hands were just flying. They had special equipment to rip open the puzzles, and it was hilarious and delightful. And the Russians, I am proud of myself, because in the book, which closed long before this Ukraine war, I said, I hate Vladimir Putin. I hate him for many reasons, but I got to meet these four women from Siberia, and it was like jigsaw diplomacy, like face to face. You're both in here doing jigsaws, and it was part of my thesis that puzzles are one way to unite the world, to save humanity. So we'll see.
That's like a theme of a lot of your books too. Like, that's the, if everybody's a cousin, then
right,
we want to go to war with everybody. Although that's unclear also. But
so cousins playing puzzles, exactly.
Yes, that's,
and
that's,
being grateful, yes, that'll solve it all.
And then delegating things they don't want to do. So
that's going to be
but
tough.
What's a good strategy for jigsaw puzzles?
Right. Well, jigsaw puzzles, I was very skeptical of them. I was snobby in the beginning. It was one of the only puzzles I didn't love. But I was wrong. There are so many nuances to jigsaws. One is when you're faced with, we all do it usually by color, like looking for the color. But when you get to the top level, if you're faced with one color, like a big sky, then they will take the pieces and arrange them on a table. Here are the pieces with three knobs and one hole. Here are the pieces with two knobs and two holes, and so on. And then you're able to do it very quickly. So that I loved. I loved that when you get to a certain level, you get very good at looking at the subtleties of the color. So take the sky again. The sky is not always going to be the same color blue. It's usually going to have shadings. So these people say, you know, nothing is black and white. That's the lesson. Everything is grays. So look for the subtle shadings of what's in the sky. And also hold up, this was a good one that I use a lot, is when you're not sure if two pieces fit, then you can hold it up to the light and see if anything sneaks through, any light. But it was just remarkable to see these people and how fast their hands moved.
And they must be so good at recognizing, like you say, like all the different patterns and shades, and also looking at two pieces and seeing right away that they fit together.
Right.
So, and what's a good, what other strategies did you learn? Like, you mentioned a whole bunch of Sudoku strategies that I never heard of. And so just what's a good Sudoku strategy?
Well, yeah, they had the crazy names like the flying X. I can't even remember them, but I talked to several of the greatest Sudoku and Ken players. By the way, are you Sudoku and Ken, or do you take sides?
I've never played Ken, but after reading about it, I've heard about it, of course, and after reading about it in your book, I want to try it. But Sudoku, I've done for a long time.
Well, it is funny because there are people in each group that are like, they hate each other. They're like the Jets and the Sharks. Like Ken people look down on Sudoku people, and vice versa.
Just from the way you describe it, I would probably look down on the Sudoku people, even though I'm a Sudoku person. Like Ken was like Sudoku plus math. It like seemed a lot harder.
It's got another element. Well, Sudoku people have their rebuttals to that. But I did, I guess the strategy, again, it's you can take the normal route of trying to find what's missing, or then you look at what you have and see. So you take it from both sides. I didn't explain that very well, but it's in the book. And what I loved about that chapter, if you might remember, is there's this debate in the Sudoku and Ken community about whether computers can create Sudokus as well as humans. And I love this debate because it's like it's sort of a microcosm of, are computers going to replace humans? Because the guy who invented Ken, he says the computer-generated Kens are soulless. They don't tell a story. He says, mine are a work of art. He literally says, they're like a Michelangelo. They have soul. They have, I'm an artist. They tell a story. They have heart. And when I look at this one generated by a computer, it means nothing to me. It's trash.
Yeah, that,
and
I just that thought made that me want to try. Yeah, that made me want to try Ken because Sudoku, I don't think that's possible. I think human generated and computer generated is probably, you can't tell the difference, but is my guess. I don't know. I could be wrong. But Ken, I'm curious what he means because I could see how there could be some artistry to those problems depending on how you do the math parts of it.
Yeah, and I hope he's right. I hope he's right. I'm a little skeptical, but I hope there's still room for humans. I mean, Garry Kasparov, when I brought this up to him, because computers are, of course, better than humans at chess, but they're also can solve chess problems that we can't. Like, there are chess problems are structured so that it's like mate in one means you have to move one piece and you'll mate the opponent. Mate in two is you move two pieces and you'll mate the opponent. There are problems where you have to move 537 times to mate black. And there's no way humans can do this. And Garry said he's watched machines solve these 537 mate problems, and he has no idea what's going on for the first 400 moves. He's like, what the hell is the computer doing? And then it suddenly starts to make sense to him. But he is optimistic. He says machines and humans will work together in the future. We're not going to be taken over. And he is a lot smarter than me, so I guess
I like his quote. He's the first knowledge worker to potentially be replaced by a computer because he was the first world chess champion to lose to a computer. And it kind of made people wonder, like, is that the end of chess? But of course, it's just like saying, oh, a car means you don't have to race anymore. Like, marathon should be over now because we could just drive a marathon. But that's silly. And computers now are useful for training chess and for understanding strategies that humans previously, so it's improved the game because computers have introduced strategies that people previously thought were not so good. And it turns out they're better than people thought. But the problem is that people cheat. And so, like, you could go to a tournament and there's always a danger someone's cheating.
How do they cheat?
Well, they might have, they're supposed to not do this, but they could potentially bring their phone into the bathroom and, check the computer or online. Cheating is rampant online. Like, every day, if you play online a lot, then the next day you'll see, one of your games, that somebody cheated. And so you get rating points back. But it's hard, there's a lot of software to catch cheaters, but you can't make 100% perfect software. And if someone could make great software, that would make like millions of dollars just because it's such a big problem.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, because there's money at stake. If in a lot of these online tournaments, you're playing for money, even in poker, there's computers now are better than humans at poker. And so much poker is online. If you have computer assistants, that could be very, it makes it unfair to people who just want to play the game. So,
right.
So, but it is an interesting thing though about whether the artistry could be recreated. I mean, now there's computers that make musical compositions that people can't tell if this is a Mozart piece or not. So, eventually that artistry will be there if they just learn to do that.
Well, that's what I'm worried. I mean, are they going to have fun interview podcasts by a robot? That will replace the James Altucher.
Okay,
3000.
Let's see. I will ask a question to an AI engine right now.
Good idea.
Okay. Let's see. The question is the puzzle here is what question can I ask this AI that will give me a good answer? So questions I should ask about puzzles.
I love it. All right, this is good.
Let me see. Let me do what questions. Should I ask about puzzles? So,
and are you just doing, is Google, is that the robot?
No. So again, this website I made to keep track of idea lists, notepad.com, allows AI to finish your, okay. So here's what the AI came up with.
Okay.
What is the objective of a puzzle?
Great question, AI.
Yeah.
You are super good. Can you kick out James? Cause we don't need him anymore.
but then it asks also questions like, what are the rules of the, so it thinks I'm talking about one puzzle.
What else does it ask?
Okay, what questions should I ask about strategies?
What about riddle
puzzles?
I'm interested. Oh yeah, the strategies for solving, that's good. But you asked good ones about that. What about something we haven't talked about yet, like riddles or...
Or how about this? What questions should I ask AJ Jacobs? Let's see if it knows who you are.
I like that. So it's hooked up to Google and the internet.
How has your work as a human guinea pig affected your life?
Thank you for asking, AI. An excellent question. Well, it has made my life better overall, because I do think the more experiments you do in life, the more interesting takeaways. And they can be painful at times while you're doing them. But I love doing experiments. I'm actually doing one right now. So just to pause on puzzles for a second, what is your take on talking to yourself? James, are you a fan?
You mean out loud or?
Yes, yeah.
Out loud? I don't do it. I don't think I've thought about it. I have a problem though, where I will, if something's bothering me, I can't help but like blurt out what I'm thinking.
Interesting. But that's in public. Well, that's with other people or that's
yeah, with other people, I can't help it. And like my kids used to say, like if they had friends over and I would do that, like my kids used to have to tell their friends, like, oh, he just does that sometimes.
Well, yeah, that is a whole other
experiment.
That's
another thing. But tell me what you mean by talking to yourself, like inspirational talking, like cheer up.
I just instead of keeping my thoughts to myself while I'm alone, I'll just say them. I'll say, you know, I'm thinking about what I should do over the weekend or what I should have for dinner. And I'm trying it for a week and we'll see if I keep it. But what I like about it is a lot of times my mind will go to weird, dark, negative spaces and, you know, ruminate about silly things. Yeah, I can't believe this guy didn't call me back. What an asshole. And then when I say it out loud and I hear myself, then I'm able to say, oh, you know what? That's a waste of time. Don't stop thinking like that. Stop being a sniveling baby. Let's think of something more interesting. So that's the advantage. We'll see if it's worth looking like a crazy person.
So here's what the AI says. I asked the AI, is it good to talk to yourself? And it says, talking to yourself can be a form of self-reflection, which can be helpful in order to understand and process your own thoughts and feelings.
AI,
you and I... And process them out loud.
You and I are on the same wavelength, AI. You are good. I love that. I love the AI.
So what puzzles did you enjoy the most?
Well, I loved learning about new genres that I knew nothing about. So... first of all, jigsaws. I didn't know that there were so many wild variations. I didn't know much about riddles. And that's one of the things I liked writing the book is I got to include. There are hundreds of puzzles in the book, including new ones, and a contest, which we can talk about at some other point, like an actual contest secret in the book, and you have to find it. And if you solve it, you get $10,000, the first one to solve. And by the way, you don't have to buy the book. The code is in the introduction, which will be online at thepuzzler.com. So no purchase necessary, but that is in the book. So anyway, I loved learning about new types of puzzles. Riddles I had never given much thought to, but I ran across these people who spend their professors, like actual endowed professors, who spend their lives analyzing riddles from the Middle Ages. And can I give you one?
Yeah,
I don't know
yeah.
if you remember this one, but this one is one of the ones that they study. Because what's interesting is these were written in 1100 by monks, but the twist is some of them are very, very naughty, like just super dirty. So, you know, it's still PG-13, but let me just tell you, here's the riddle. What am I? My stem is erect. I stand up in bed, hairy down below. An attractive peasant's daughter grips me, plunders my head, and feels my encounter. This woman with braided hair gets her eye wet. So what am I?
I mean, there's all sorts of like dirty things it could be, I guess.
Right. Yes, but get your mind out of the gutter. I mean, that's the beauty of it. It is not a dirty answer because the monks wanted to trick you. They wanted to say, so the answer is, I'll give you one hint. Yeah. The end, it says her eye. So when you're dealing with this thing, your eye is wet. So you're crying. You're crying when you're dealing with this. And it's...
But hair down below.
Well, it's not... it's metaphorical hair. So it's like, you know, the stringy part of a certain vegetable that makes you...
Oh, I don't know.
Makes you cry.
Tell me the
answer. What vegetable makes you cry?
Oh, an onion.
It's an onion. You got it with no hints whatsoever.
No, but yeah. You can see a million I didn't know an onion had hair down below.
Well, if you see an onion that's, you know, not been processed, it's kind of got that stringy stuff.
That assumes I only see vegetables in stores after they've already been processed completely. They've been processed, they've been grown here, sent to China, processed, sent back here, shipped to a grocery store, and that is the first time I lay eyes on them.
So you're not a medieval monk. Okay, that is good to know.
You know, you said something in the beginning when you were talking about the MIT puzzles, that the question arose, which is, if these people are so smart, why are they wasting their time doing puzzles? And I think a lot about this because it seems like there are some activities where you're allowed to ask that question, meaning, let's say you meet someone who all day long, that's what they do. They do puzzles. Will Shorts, all day long, he does puzzles and thinks about puzzles. So, you know, for some reason, it's acceptable to ask someone who does puzzles, why are you doing this when you could, it's just something kids do or whatever people say. But like, then nobody asked this of like, you know, the marketing manager for Crest toothpaste. Like, oh, if you're so smart, like, why are you just doing marketing for Crest toothpaste? Like, I guess because a paycheck sort of, is considered a valid reason. Like if you get a weekly paycheck or whatever, a regular paycheck, it's considered a valid reason to do something. Whereas puzzles, maybe someone is not making as much money as they could be because they love spending 20 hours a week doing puzzles. And I think about this a lot because lately I've been playing chess a lot. And of course you ask the question like, oh, isn't that just a game? Like, why are you doing that? So I feel though they're, it's just a valid activity as anything else. Like, what's the problem?
I am with you. Well, first of all, I love that you're playing chess again. And as you know, and you can cut this out if you want, I want you to write a book like what chess has taught me about life or why chess is good. Because I think that would be fascinating.
No,
and I think it would sell.
Yeah, and I think what I've been doing, the whole process of coming back to it as an adult, mm-hmm. that I will... And this is an AJ style book because I'm immersing myself in it. That
yeah.
I will probably do. And also, you know who also is really encouraging on this is Robert Greene. He's like, oh my God, this is an amazing book. Like, you have to do this. So,
and he sold like, you know, millions more than me. So he knows what he's talking about.
I don't know.
About.
You've sold millions. You've sold your millions.
You're nice. but I think it's a fascinating question. And it's got a long history. Like, you look, there have always been people who say, every time that there's a puzzle craze, they're like, oh my God, I can't. When crosswords were invented in 1913, all of these newspapers were publishing them. But even back then, the Times was a little snooty and they refused to publish them. They thought it was too lowbrow. And instead, they published articles. It is hilarious to see the articles in the 20s and 30s that crosswords were like a dangerous vice. They are like a reefer. Like people were... you know, they caused arguments, the breaks up of marriage, the murders. There were jailhouse riots they covered, people going blind from crossword puzzles. So it was like this panic, this moral panic about crossword puzzles. But now, then they totally did a 180 and they, in 1942, started doing crosswords. And now they're like the go-to place for puzzles. And I think you see this in every technology. You see, you know, when books came out, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe they're going to ruin the world.
We're even up to Google. Like, everyone thought Google was going to make us stupid because, oh, you know, you don't have to know facts anymore. God forbid right. you didn't know like a fact and now you have to Google it. But, you know, of course, there's always the next evolution in thinking. Like you have to now understand the facts and use them wisely as opposed to just knowing
exactly.
them.
Exactly. And same with puzzles. I think, you know, quite the opposite from ruining our minds. They are sharpening our minds. So there's always been this tension because even when puzzles started, like the first puzzle book of the 1600s was called Sharpening the Minds of the Youth. So there's always this tension between puzzles are the savior, the thing that's going to make us smarter, versus the puzzles are what is going to turn our brains into oatmeal.
But, you know, I guess there's like there's the potential to get obsessed with puzzles, though, because they are fun and they do release dopamine. And you could get addicted to that dopamine of, oh, I solved another Sudoku puzzle. I got to keep going until I get harder and harder. And, you know, you look at like Marcel Duchamp, who you mentioned in the book, famous artist. He was on his way to having like the most amazing artistic career on the planet. And at the age of 36, he basically retired for the next 30 years just to solve chess puzzles.
I know. Right. That like anything, it can be addictive. And once you get to that point, then it does actually harm your life. And there was, I mean, one of the most interesting characters I met was this guy whose last 2 years of his life were spent obsessing over a single puzzle. And it's a famously difficult puzzle. It's sort of a math logic puzzle. It's sort of like the Monty Hall puzzle, which you probably know.
Yeah.
Where, but it's like 1,000 times harder and more complex. And it has spawned 100 actual philosophy papers that in real philosophy with, and it's called the Sleeping Beauty Problem. I'm not going to give it because it's too weird and complicated. But if you Google Sleeping Beauty Problem, just promise me you won't spend 2 years. Because this guy, he spent 2 years, he said he was staring at the wall for 8 hours a day thinking about it. And his wife was freaking out, saying, you know, this is not good for you.
That problem actually is almost worthy of an entire podcast because I am 100% a halfer. And I know you're a thirder.
You're a halfer?
I am a halfer.
Oh, wow.
And
you know, I'm interested.
You know why? And I'll just, people should Google this problem, but so I won't take more than a minute on this, but tell me if you disagree. As opposed to the Monty Hall problem, where in the middle of the problem, new information is given, which changes the answer. There's no new information given in the Sleeping Beauty problem. So the odds remain the same as at the beginning of the problem.
That is the perfect halfer argument. And I still don't buy it. I still don't buy it because if you are told at the beginning of the problem, all of the parameters, then I still do think you would be a thirder. But listen, this is way over my head. I mean, these are people who spend their lives, they're professional mathematicians, and they still argue about it. So you could be right. I don't know.
Oh, I guess I could see the thirder side, which is that if she's asked what day it is,
mm-hmm.
then it's a much more complicated problem. And that's
yeah.
related to the odds. Like, then it's not so clear that she should treat it like a 50-50 situation.
Well, one thing I love about that problem and some problems like it is that if you work at it, you can see both sides. And that is another important mental skill, being able to see the world from two different sides. And we talked about that on our mini show, Good or Bad. How important it is to see the world from someone else's point of view. And flexibility. I mean, that is another huge theme of this puzzle adventure is cognitive flexibility. That's the only way you're going to solve the hard problems.
And I do
think...
Don't
become attached.
Practicing puzzles is good exercise. Like, you are exercising that whatever muscle it is in the brain for cognitive flexibility. Like, that is insanely valuable.
Totally.
And so, like, what's... I recommended earlier, you have to do something to learn something, but what's a good way people could think about how to be cognitively flexible?
Well, I do think puzzles are great practice, but even when you're when you're not doing puzzles, I think it's important to assign a probability to your beliefs. And this is related to sort of Bayesian thinking. So don't say, you know, it is when my wife, I actually do this maybe to the extreme. So if my wife says, calls me and says, what time are you going to be home? I'll say, there's a 60% chance I'll be home by 7, but there's a 30% chance I'll be home by.
I feel like all of your books in part are methods for you to annoy Julie, but then you have an excuse. This is what I'm getting paid to do this. I'm just doing this. And well, so you chose a career that's just designed to annoy your wife. So,
well, you know that she did get like all these readers in emailed and said, you have to do a month where you do everything your wife says. So she did have that month a few years ago of like whatever it was, foot rubs. And
that's funny.
But that is, yeah, that's taking it perhaps to the extreme. But when you are looking at any complex issue, think in probabilities. Don't think in black and white and certainties and uncertainties. Think in shades.
I also like your reverse strategy. So like do the opposite of what is expected. So for instance, in the Gauss situation, he didn't add up the numbers in order. He came up with a completely unique way of adding these numbers up so that it becomes trivial to solve the problem. Or in chess, in a game, there's often like, there's one move. It looks like I just cannot make that move. And most people will never think about the move because you're not supposed to make that kind of move. Sacrificing your queen. Start by thinking of that move instead of just automatically discounting it. So this reversal thinking works in all sorts of puzzles.
Absolutely. Yeah, do the unexpected. As you say, in all types of puzzles, there's... I covered Japanese puzzle boxes, which are these wooden boxes that sometimes cost thousands of dollars, and to solve them, you have to do what's totally unexpected. So, you know, you try to open it, just it's a box, you try to open the lid, nothing. So you have to do things like you have to spin the box and then it releases. Sometimes you have to freeze it. That's another one that's crazy. So sometimes it won't open until you freeze it. So yeah, do something that with the box that you never thought of.
Yeah, or and like with riddles or crossword puzzles, it's never the obvious answer. Like in the riddle you just said with the monks and the girl, like, you know, it's never the obvious, like, oh, this is a whatever.
Right.
It's a vegetable. So it's a cookbook. You ever see that Twilight Zone? They're trying to...
Oh, yeah.
So
that is... Well, it has a lot, like you say, it has a lot of in common with great stories and great fiction, because that also has a twist at the end.
Yeah, actually, if you think about it, right, every novel is a puzzle because, like, the most obvious example being a mystery novel. Who did it? And the reader... It's constantly trying to figure out who did it by the end. And the challenge of the author is really like the same as the challenge of a puzzle maker, which is not make it too obvious, but not make it too difficult. But again, it's a fine line because you don't want them to figure it out until the author wants it to be revealed. So it's all mystery. Basically, the more interesting and well thought out the mystery is in a novel, usually the more successful that novel is. So like the best mystery novels, the one we know best, are by the authors who are the best at making these puzzles.
Right. But what you said, I think, is there's a sweet spot. And the guy who made the puzzles for this book, because there are 20 original puzzles, very hard, very interesting. He said the easiest thing in the world is to make a puzzle that's impossible, that no one can solve. And it's also pretty easy to make a totally simple puzzle. That you got to find the sweet spot where it's just hard enough that you can solve it, but that you are given this challenge, this sort of period where you're frustrated, you're like, and then you get to that revelation at the end.
You know, I'm surprised you didn't, or maybe you did cover, I don't remember, you know, like Google interview questions. Like Google kind of mastered the art of asking puzzles as questions,
and
they don't always expect the potential employees to have the right answers, but they want to see the thinking process.
Right. Well, I did actually, it's not a major part, but I did talk about and give an example of Fermi problems, which is sort of the official name for a lot of the Google interview type questions, where they ask, how many piano tuners are there in Chicago?
Oh, yeah, yeah, right, okay.
And the way to solve those is a very important tool for all types of thinking, which is if you just take a wild guess, like, you know, 28,000, then it's going to be off by orders of magnitude, most likely. So the best way to do it is to break it down into small chunks. How many people live in Chicago? How many people on average, what percentage of people on average have pianos? How often do pianos need to be tuned? How many pianos can a piano tuner tune in one day? And then, even if you're off on each of those guesses, the end is going to be closer than just a random guess.
Well, this reminds me of a famous podcast we did, I believe, in 2015, where it was based on a Facebook post you did, which went insanely viral, and it was basically Ann Coulter. You were watching some show. You're obsessed with Ann Coulter, and you're watching her on TV, and she said something was said relating to Israel, and she said, "Well, how many effing Jews are there anyway?" And she used the full word for effing. And you said, "Well, let's figure this out. How many Jews are having sex right now around the world?" And you used that exact technique and did this Facebook post, and it got like a million shares, and we did a podcast about it.
That is so funny. I totally forgotten that that is a Fermi problem. Yes. Yeah. How many Jews are having sexual intercourse at any given moment?
Yeah.
That is so funny.
So look, AJ, I really enjoy this book because it has all the AJ components of you sort of putting yourself in these crazy situations and then things happen. You're like, I don't want to use the word nerdy because it's not that, but you're like,
I am a proud nerd. I'm okay with that.
But it's like a nerdy version of what Hunter S. Thompson does. So like Hunter S. Thompson will like load up on drugs, every drug possible, and then go to the Democratic National Convention and things happen. You take yourself and your quirky personality, you don't need any drugs, you take your quirky personality and go to the MIT puzzle solving competition, or you represent the US in the jigsaw puzzle competition, and on and on. And it's such a great genre that you've mastered, that you're the only person, and you've uniquely mastered it. And it's always enjoyable to read your stories, but there's so much to learn. You always pack it in with so much knowledge, which what's clever about that is you give people many ways to like a story or like a book. So they might, maybe they like it, maybe they're not interested in genealogy, but they want to see how you found, you know, did the world's largest family reunion, how you found all your cousins, or, you know, or maybe they don't care about your story at all, and they want to read all about the history of all these different puzzles and strategies for doing these puzzles and interviews with the people who are the world champions of these puzzles. And so there's multiple ways for people to like your books.
You are better at explaining my books than I am.
Well,
Thank
I always try to break that down your approach.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait for the James Altucher chess book. But in the meantime, yes, please, if you're interested, buy The Puzzler, or you can read the intro, which contains the secret code on thepuzzlerbook.com. And I hope it's the intro is enough to make you want to actually buy the book.
And win $10,000 in the process, potentially.
Right. Potentially.
Are you going to announce a winner at some point, or is it just the first person who solves the puzzle?
It is the first person who solves the puzzle. Well, what happens is in the intro, you have to figure out there's a passcode. There's a phrase that will be revealed in the introduction, and it's hidden. It's secret. But once you do that, then you actually have to put that passcode into a box in the Puzzler book.com, and that is your passcode to a whole forest of crazy creative puzzles that I did not make, that my friends from the MIT Mystery Hunt made. And they are hard, but they are fun and weird and fascinating. And the first one to finish all of those puzzles, there are over 20 of them, so you have to work for your money, then that person gets the $10,000.
This is great. Such a great idea for a book too. Well, good luck. We should do a good or bad about puzzles as well in our good or bad series. And what can we? You got me going. I want to compete again on something. Like, is there a website we can compete on Sudoku? Like, we could race to finish a bunch of Sudoku
puzzles.
You're
gonna kick my ass.
I might not. I haven't played Sudoku in a while.
No, but you've just got the mind. You've got the mathematical mind or the logical mind that is going to trounce me. I'll do it. I'll be embarrassed and I'll beg Jay to take. I think I could definitely, if I share my screen, I'm pretty decent at spelling bee. And all right, here I have spelling bee. I usually do it first thing in the morning, even in the middle of the night sometimes.
I'm going to have to try this. Is that the New York Times site?
Yeah, it's very addictive. I don't want you to try it. I stay with chess because you got to write
a book
on chess.
I got a book to write. Then I'll get obsessed with this.
Exactly.
But all right. So what's the next book? It's not going to be about talking to yourself, is it?
I don't think so. That might be an article. Who knows? I haven't decided. I have been still focused on puzzles. I'm always counting on you because you are an idea machine. So you're always giving me great ideas.
The thing you should do, though, is you should now make some puzzle books.
Mm.
Like you should make.
Well, that's right. You told me I had to do that.
Yeah.
To monetize.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's like a no-brainer because Will Shortz has written over 500 books of crossword puzzles and Sudoku. And those are probably computer-generated, some of them.
Right.
So
exactly.
And now you're going to have a brand name in the puzzle space. Should totally do puzzles or make a puzzle site and maybe invent your own puzzles. Cause look, that guy who made Ken, I wonder what he's worth now. Cause he's like, you know, he basically created a whole genre of puzzle.
I know he should be. Maybe he was worth, well, he's kind of like, he's funny cause he's kind of like a monk. All he cares about is the artistry. He doesn't care about money or so it seems.
All right. Well, AJ, say hi to Julie and the kids and we should definitely do a good or bad sometime soon. Maybe this month is getting pretty booked and you have this book coming out on April 26th, but let's plan on May doing some good or bads. Do we have any good or bads left to release?
We have a couple. I'll have to listen to see if they are releasable, but we might be able to squeeze a couple more, but I'm also up for doing new ones if you are.
Yeah, no, definitely. Cool. Well,
all right.
AJ, thanks so much.
I
really love the book. It was really a great book. Like,
thank you, James.
I'm excited to recommend it. So
that means a lot.
All right.
All right.
See you guys later.
Sounds good. Bye-bye.